Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 26. My name is Scroobius Pip. Thank you for tuning in. We've got a great guest this week. It's Mr. Wes Borland. It's been weird. There's been a few that we've done recently. Frank Turner, Billy Bragg, and now Wes, that I felt that for some reason these could have just gone on for hours and hours. It was the most comfortable and natural, and all of them have been good. I've enjoyed all of them, but there's been a few where it's just felt, damn, I wish I didn't have to end it here, which it kind of feels I should. So I'm going to jump straight into this and give our sponsors, actually. We are sponsored by Speech Development Records. That is my label, speechdevelopmentrecords.com. It is free to go and look at everything. You just have to pay if you want any of it, which is the stickler there. But please check it out. And if you enjoy the podcast, you know, if you've listened to more than a few, that's already several hours of free entertainment you've got. So maybe buy a t-shirt or a cap or a mug. You can buy a mug to drink your tea in while listening to this podcast. Check us out. Our other sponsor this week is onit.com. Onit is a human optimization website. They sell tons of exercise stuff, which is absolutely awesome. I really want some of their stuff. Some of it's too expensive to get over here, basically. But maybe it's better if you've got a 10% discount, eh? Which you can get by going to onit.com/scroobiuspip. onit.com/scroobiuspip. They sell a lot of fitness stuff, some supplements, but they also sell nootropics, which are kind of supplements for your brain. And they're the bits I order and get shipped in. So I recommend you check them out. That's the sponsors for now. I'm going to be back at the end to tell you about the second podcast this week, because we're still trying to do this 2-a-week thing in March. It's pretty difficult because Wargie has to tag them all and we have to record them and they're long. But we got two this week, and I'll tell you who the next one is at the end of the podcast. But for now, enjoy Mr. Wes Borland.
Throw my jacket off.
And that is it. No, you take your jacket off, you get comfy. Perfect. I'm joined by Mr. Wes Borland. How you doing, man?
I'm very well, Pip. Not too much jet lag.
That's always good.
Day before yesterday, and here to play a series of shows with my girlfriend.
It's a rarity to get that, or to not be hit by it at all, right? So you just slept all the way through the flight, and you're good.
I'm good, yeah. I mean, I took a little nap, and after I got in, then ready to roll, good to go.
It's perfect. It's got to be interesting, because when this goes out, it'll be after the shows, which,
it'll be March.
Yeah. So how exciting is it to be coming over and doing more intimate and more... a lot of the venues that I'd imagine some of them you've probably heard of but didn't do, because by the time you were coming over here with Limp Bizkit and with things like that, you were, you know, in venues bigger than this. So
yeah, I think the first time that we started coming over here with Bizkit, we were opening for Korn at places like almost like Brixton Academy size places, because they were, you know, headlining.
Yeah, of course.
We didn't even have an album out at that point.
Yeah.
But the thing I've been doing lately, playing in, my girlfriend's name is Karay Calloway. And
yeah.
She's had a band called Queen Kwong for many, many years now that's had several different lineups. She's always, you know, the main person. It's her band. And she is the band in many ways. Or in hallways. But we have an interesting lineup right now, because we've got Hayden Scott on drums, who's this amazing, hard-hitting drummer from Australia that's played with Brody Dahl and Filter and AWOL Nation.
Awesome.
And all these different people.
Yeah.
And a really good friend of mine, Fred Sablon, who was just played in Manson for about 4 years on bass. And me on guitar. And I originally wasn't going to, I don't know, for some reason, she and I weren't considering me as a possibility to play guitar in the band. Yeah. But another guy we were talking to fell through, and I just said, I'll do it. She goes, I know you're doing it. And I went, oh, I am? And she's like, yeah, you're doing it. So I went, oh, I mean, you know, okay. So we started playing shows around L.A., and I've played shows like this with my, I have a secondary band called Blacklight Burns that I'm active with, you know, here and there. And that band's almost 10 years old now, which
That's
is a
crazy.
Crazy 4 albums, 10 years. But so I'm not unused to, you know, lugging my own gear and, you know, touring in a van and doing stuff like that. But these Queen Kwong shows have been even more intimate than that in smaller places. And it's really cool just loading up my truck, dumping the gear out, throwing it up on stage and going and just kind of hanging out in the bar and doing and kind of having that experience, because it's, you know, one day I'll be doing that and 2 days later I'll be on a plane flying to who knows where and playing a giant, you know, festival with Biscuit.
It's crazy. It's crazy how quickly when you get to a certain level or get, it's not even a an ego thing, but when you get used to a certain level of how everything has to be exactly like this and it's perfect and all that, it's when you then get to do the shows that, I mean, if it's a side thing, then that's great. If it's the main thing and you're like, right, this is shit, but we're going to get through it. It's when you realise it's doable, man. It can be really enjoyable. It doesn't have to be this perfect scenario every time.
It doesn't.
That's what makes it exciting, is the actual, the variation of it.
Yeah, it's so, you know, it's so easy. It's not difficult. I mean, it's easier just with less people involved and a little more elbow grease. You end up having like a much better time because you're just putting your stuff up and you're talking to people. You're having conversations, you know, 5 seconds before you go. I mean, you go on stage. I talk to guys who are like, I can't believe I'm talking to you. I've been fan of you for, you know, 15, 20 years. And as I'm setting up, we're going through my pedals and they're asking me questions. And it's just this really easy, fun way to communicate with people that isn't like a sterile meet and greet where I'm already primed at like a meet and greet to sort of go into autopilot and go, oh, thank you so much. Okay, yeah, very nice to meet you. Yep. Okay, thanks. Yeah, that's very nice of you to say, oh, that was you. Okay, you know, and dealing
completely
with people in that way, it's just this laid back, easy, I don't know, there's something about it that's just charming and
particularly
and
in
real
a setting
feeling.
Up type situation as well, because it's something you're very familiar with as well, but not familiar with as any kind of performance. And like, I've always done the merch after my shows and I love meeting the fans.
We've been doing that too.
But it's weird because even in that you get into some kind of not performance mode, but you're very ready with, thanks a lot for coming, I hope you enjoy. Do you know what I mean? So even though that is a real personal touch, it becomes almost slightly automated at times. I remember I've had stuff where someone said something that's caught me off guard and it's been really deep and emotional or something, and I've been kind of, all right, cool, well, nice, just because I've not known what to say because I'm so in that situation.
Yeah, because you're in
that mode. Okay, cool, well, that's cool. And it's like, shit, you've just said something really beautiful and heartfelt and I've kind of shaken your hand and said, bye, but because there's 100 other people kind of stood there. So it must be nice to be taken out of that, as you said, when you're in a setting up mode, in a all that kind of thing. It's a different interaction with a fan base that you've
completely
not had in a while, I'd imagine.
Because I've had trouble being a little bit socially awkward, especially in situations where I'm interfacing with fans, because I don't take compliments well, and I don't really know what to say a lot of the time.
I'm exactly the same. It's the most awkward of things.
And if there's a subject to talk about, like if I'm in the midst of doing something and there's people who are like-minded or asking questions that I have answers to, you know, it becomes a lot easier for me and easier for them, I think.
Yeah.
Because people have said, you know, I've had everything from Wes is one of the nicest guys I've ever met, down to earth, to, but like, that guy was a real dickhead. And it's mainly because I don't know what to say to you. I don't know what to say. I'm not good at this sometimes, you know.
And how that can be perceived by an individual person who's been waiting for ages for that moment, and then you've not had the perfect response that they were hoping you'd have.
Exactly.
It's suddenly, how's that getting
exactly? Or you just drop, you just broke a piece of your gear while you're trying to load off stage and tripped over a cable, and then they're like, "Hey man, can we get a picture with you?" And I'm like, "Yes, but not right
not
now."
Right,
and
then,
then
here,
all of a sudden
now.
They're gone, and then online I'm getting some sort of interaction. Like
we've all seen that. I remember I had one where. When we played Coco, we did a 2 nights at Coco, and it was our biggest headline thing. And previously we'd played there, and I hadn't done the merch because it's too big to do the merch. But I was like, no, these shows mean the world to me. We had Billy Bragg come on and guest with us, and it was like this amazing thing. I was like, I'm doing the merch. And Dan normally goes out the front, so we're kind of separated in where the fans can hit us up, so it's not just a bottleneck.
Yeah.
And I'm doing that, and one guy was saying to Dan how he's like, "Pitman, it's just so, you know, he's doing merch. It's just so commercial. It's just only that." It's like, I'm here to meet the fans. And
what, it's so commercial to do merch that,
stuff as well. And it's like, well, it is a really
weird
thing.
Does it get more punk rock than selling your own merch?
Exactly, exactly. That's the start of everything.
I'm not
but that's the,
sure
the
if
thing
it does.
I also feel is, it's. I'm not going to lie, if I do the merch, I make more money from merch than if I don't. But it's really a win-win for everyone because I really enjoy meeting all the fans. And they, I've been to shows. I remember the first time I saw Sage Francis and saw he was selling the merch. I bought albums I already had because I was like, shit, I can buy it off him and he can sign it and it means something to him. It's like, no one's losing there. Yet you're still going to have someone online going, for fuck's sake, it's commercial.
They'll find
just catching
some
in.
Reason to, some reason to do that.
You were talking about setting up there. I've got a list of things, of notes of things I should hit up. And one was kind of against what would be my natural questioning as of I need to give something to the guitar nerd who's going to have tuned in. So what pedals and what is your current setup? And is it a different setup for your different bands?
Yeah, for Biscuit, my pedal board is large. It's almost 6 feet wide.
Damn.
And it's and in Biscuit, I run two different guitar rigs.
Yeah.
So I have a clean combo amp that's a Roland Jazz Chorus for my clean channel.
Yeah.
And then I have a distortion tube head and cabinet for my distortion channel.
Yeah.
And my pedal board is essentially two pedal boards that have sort of a train track switch in the middle of them. So that while I'm on one, I'm setting up what's going to happen with the pedals on the other one.
Right, yeah, cool.
And vice versa. So, but
that's crazy.
With this, I'm using one pedal board, and there's a lot going on, but I've got a couple of pedals that do a lot. And they're pre-programmable, and I actually ended up, they do so much that I actually took a hot glue gun right before we left and glued and put hot glue all over a bunch of the knobs so that I won't, so that I won't hit them during the show.
That's great. Do you find it kind of one influences the other at all? So do you think the more stripped down setup you're using now makes you change your perspective on what you want to use in future with Biscuit, or is that very much that's the setup that's been built over time to feed all your needs?
Well, for this, what I did was, Courageous did a new record with co-written with Joe Cardamone from the Icarus line, and they did it together, and Joe's playing guitar on all of it pretty much.
Yeah.
So when I built the setup, I built it based on her old songs and her new songs.
Right.
And that's always a challenge to take someone else's material and someone else's playing style.
Yeah.
Try to make it your own and you know, mix it with who I am as a player, but also trying to emulate the parts and do them justice.
Yeah.
So
you can't kind of come in and try and be, oh, here's how I do it. You know, it's my show.
Yeah, so I started from scratch and built a whole guitar rig just based on her albums.
Yeah.
And, my guitar rig and Biscuit is based on all of the albums combined, the songs we play.
Yeah.
And it just, The pedal board and biscuit has gotten so large that at this point, when we write new material, I try to not use pedals that aren't already on the board.
Aren't already there. Yeah. Can't add anything else.
Yeah, to try to just keep it to a minimum. And but that's sort of, I'm, for stuff that I'm wanting to do in the future, I've started to think about what I can subtract from my gear and right. from my life. I've been thinking about recently what my go-tos are. Like,
yeah.
I always go to this. I'm always starting a riff or writing by approaching a guitar in this way.
Yeah.
And I've started to try to make notes and take into consideration what those things are, and I have a desire to start wanting to take them away.
Right.
So that I'm not able to
yeah, so it's,
to,
it's
to use them anymore.
Fresh again. You've whether, not got the crutch to fall.
Yeah,
to
like whether it's getting rid of pedals that I've used for years and years mm-hmm. and that I always go to, like tape delays or whatnot, or you know, a tremolo on a guitar or a certain type of amp. I think I'm even for the next project that I'm doing, I'm going to remove the two low strings off of all the guitars that I use
right.
so that I'm Damn. Have to play chords on the four high strings. And
yeah.
I'm just starting to try to work handicaps into future projects
yeah, yeah.
In order to make myself grow as a player.
And, yeah, no,
and
that's great. And try to take it in different directions.
Yeah. Make rules,
yeah.
You know, always try to make rules. I always liked that the yeah, yeah, yeahs obviously aren't this way anymore, but I liked when they started that they their whole kind of the whole theme and energy and intention of the band was to use very little. You know,
yeah.
Nick was using his guitar rig was yeah, not yeah, yeah. not a lot was happening, and you know, drums and vocals and. I feel that the less you have to work with, the more creativity flourishes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and the more you have to work with, the more you end up just stuck in a studio not doing anything. And
I think restrictions,
tweaking plugins, and
yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
for hours and hours and
restrictions
hours.
In all art, I think, are huge for creativity and giving you something to overcome and giving you some kind of challenge. I've always found it in music videos. I think I'd hate to direct a music video where I had an endless budget, because I don't think I'd make something as good. I think the fact that there's restrictions makes me go, right, I need to be creative and interested
sure.
with this and try and find a way around it. The old a Minor Threat adage of I'd rather hear music made by people who've got all these ideas but haven't quite got the skill or means to get it all out of them than people who can play everything and do everything, and therefore
sure.
it's kind of it's not as exciting and buzzing. So I guess it's putting those restrictions
yeah,
on yourself when you've got to a level where you can do what you want, essentially. So yeah.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot to be said for that, and there's a lot to for years and years, my brother and I and a friend of ours named Kyle, since we were almost pre-teenagers, have had this project, I'll quote unquote project that we do usually one or two times a year called Goat Slayer.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that other musicians while growing up may have had similar things to Goat Slayer, but it's... the three of us usually, you know, drunk or high or on LSD or mushrooms, or we would try to have some sort of element, where we're impaired, mentally impaired. Then we set up a bunch of equipment and hit record without stopping and make an album.
Yeah. Amazing.
Make an album, and that was the rule to Goat Slayer was, and it was mainly just for us. I think at some point we're going to put it all online for free
yeah.
or something, just to see, like, because we have a collection of, you know, 25 years of these. I think we have 17 or 20 albums. I mean, it's or whatever you want to call them. It's junk, but to us, it's gold.
Yeah,
it's like one of the most precious things. In my life, but what we started I had an idea with that that I actually have wanted to take into other projects. When we started, we used to just use tape players and four tracks, but then when we got Pro Tools,
yeah,
we decided to start setting up musical obstacle courses,
right,
where we would plug in a bunch of beats into an hour long session and a bunch of sounds, and yeah, we would, each of us would drop it in without the other one seeing, to yeah, where there would yeah, be yeah, large gaps of silence, and then you'd come to a part where all of a sudden, like, an orchestra kicks in, and,
yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
or
yeah,
or like a hip hop beat kicks in, or something happens, and we would turn the screen off so we didn't know.
Right, yeah, so you can't see it coming.
Can't see it. Don't know where it's coming.
The anticipation
yeah,
isn't there.
And we would kind of, it's kind of like recording with a Russian roulette thing mixed with an enemy, like someone yeah, who's working against
yeah,
you, like,
yeah, yeah,
like
yeah,
at the
yeah,
same time. So that whole idea of,
I love it,
of adding obstacles and parameters and I think all of those things are very helpful to creativity.
Yeah,
things that aren't planned, keeping mistakes. I think like auto-tune is the enemy. I think that people overthinking things
yeah,
are the enemy. Copying and pasting, you know, repetitive, you know, thou shalt not make repetitive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
that,
yeah,
that
exactly.
Whole, that whole thing is, I think that it's changing the way that people who are young perceive and think about music.
Completely. I think a human error is gradually being removed, which takes out the human elements of music in many
yeah,
ways, and I think that's key.
And it's seen as a mistake now. It's
yeah,
seen as, you know, when you hear a band like Maroon 5, where the singers of that band, it's Adam... Adam
yeah,
Levine?
Yes, that's right, Adam Levine.
I'm pretty sure he has a really great voice.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of the band, but I think that he's got a great voice. But on all their recordings, it sounds to me like every single note of his voice is auto-tuned.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Across the board, like
yeah,
way more than it needs to be.
Yeah, yeah.
And people are getting used to hearing that in all music all the time, to where it's becoming, and these people are ignorant of auto-tune auto-tune's
yeah,
existence. So yeah, they think
of
a singer.
Or people have the because of the rise in over-the-top auto-tune and robotic auto-tune, people think that that's auto-tune and don't realise it goes across the board in a lot of pop music.
Yeah.
And you're not hearing it. It's
yeah,
not the Kanye West. You know,
yeah,
it doesn't
yeah,
have to be that. It's across the famous one that brought it to attention over here was the Spice Girls. That was famously, everything was auto-tuned and it just, all you heard
yeah,
was people singing. You didn't hear any robotic element or whatever, but yeah.
Yeah. It's I don't know. I just think that it's I want to see four guys in, like Minor Threat, I want to
yeah,
see four guys in a room rushing through because they don't have much studio time
yeah,
and, you know.
I've got a level of that expectation with live shows as well. In a way, I'm disappointed if I go and see a band and it's almost too good, if it's too perfect and too polished. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's kind of, I like that element of it going slightly off of human error. I've always found from doing gigs as well, well, if you're doing over 100 gigs in a year, the ones that will often stand out the most to me is when something goes slightly wrong and
yeah,
you adapt to it and you adjust and you make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, that human element of it makes that show stand out above
yeah,
all the rest because something exciting happened. It wasn't just
yeah,
we're playing these songs again, which again, I don't mean that in a unappreciative way, but when you tour,
sure,
you are, it becomes a job. You're playing all these things on, you know, on muscle memory at points. So it's kind of, it's great. When, as you said, there's kind of obstacles and elements to overcome
sure,
in the live show.
Yeah.
It makes it more enjoyable.
I've actually started, in the last few years, I've, like, during Biscuit shows, if I've had, like, a problem or something slightly out or I'm out of tune, I've taken the opportunity to stop playing on purpose
yeah,
and fix it and then start playing again
yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
drop out so
yeah,
people know
that this that is
I'm,
real.
That
this
I'm playing. Is, yeah, there, yeah. There's no, there are no guitars on tracks. There's that, like, if we stop, we stop, you know? Yeah. And I think people know that because we draw sections out of songs. And
yeah.
I mean, I guess you can do that with Ableton now when you have somebody, you know, going, okay, we're going into the, you know, next measure now.
Switch this out.
But yeah, I mean, I think that going back to the beginning of what we were talking about, because I have the rare opportunity to play with a band like Queen Kwong and be do these shows where we're loading in our own gear and setting ourselves up and there's no separation between the audience, and then I can go, you know, all of a sudden I'm on a plane flying, you know, first class to Mexico City to play in front of, you know, a 100,000 people or whatever. It's I've started to bring the feeling of that, of the punk rock stuff, into the bigger stuff.
That's perfect.
And I've noticed that it's starting to affect me to where I'm doing things that I wouldn't normally do.
Yeah.
You know, and or I have an attitude towards it that it feels too sterile, so I'll start wanting to fuck it up somehow. Yeah.
It's so, great, though, to have that and have that excitement in there. I think that kind of thing was key for me and Dan Lesak building our fan base, because, again, particularly at that point, because he was doing everything from behind a laptop screen, you assume that there was a lot of playback, but there wasn't. You know, on most of it, there wasn't any at all. He's playing it all live, he's doing all of this. So it actually kind of increased our credibility that early on, people would see us fuck up and get it wrong, because then it's that exact same thing of people going, all right, that's not just a guy rapping over a DJ or rapping over a beat. That's live music, and it gets.
Oh, and
that
don't
across.
Get me wrong, I've played to tracks before. I mean, one of my bands has played to tracks, and it's one of my least favorite things to do.
Yeah,
to be locked on. I mean, you're on rails, and if there's a mistake or you
it's
need
a different
to stop,
skill
or,
as well, man. Because you are trapped
in
that.
It's not as fun. Yeah. It's not an enjoyable experience. It takes a lot away from the artist's enjoyment of the show. To me, anyway, it does.
So what was your growing up? Like we mentioned, Minor Threat and things like that. What music were you into, and then what was your kind of path into music yourself? So what were you growing up enjoying and listening to, and what made you go, I want to have a go at this. I fancy trying this out.
Well, the first thing is that when I was a kid, I didn't have an older brother or an older cousin or any older friends that were introducing me to anything at all. I started skateboarding when I was 8 years old. And got a subscription to Thrasher magazine and was sort of taking notice of some of the bands mentioned in Thrasher magazine. But meanwhile, I was into Indiana Jones and was just like buying, I want to buy the Indiana Jones soundtrack or like the Labyrinth soundtrack. I think my first tape I ever bought was in elementary school was the Miami Vice soundtrack.
It's you know, all about
Smuggler's Blues and all... It was soundtracks because that was the movie. That was the music from the movies that you liked, that you heard in the movies.
I remember one of the first tapes I got was the Last Action Hero soundtrack, which was actually a solid soundtrack. It had AC/DC on there, but I always remember realizing in later life it had Cypress Hill When the Shit Goes Down on there.
Oh wow!
But all they'd done was change it on the sleeve to When the Ship Goes
Down. When the ship goes down.
And hadn't changed the actual recording at all, because if it's written like that, you're hearing it as When the Ship Goes Down. That's the best bit of editing I've ever heard in my life. Just like, no, they're not saying shit, they're saying ship. It's like, all right, cool.
Well, that's
cool.
A mind
that's
fuck.
Fine. I can handle that.
We're just going to mind fuck you. Punk rock and hardcore music, mostly the stuff that was like Minor Threat, DRI, Subhumans, Dead Kennedys, Black Flag, Misfits, The Damned. Those were the bands that I started playing guitar when I was 12, and those were the songs I wanted to learn.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to learn aggressive power chord songs, the bands that I'd seen in Thrasher magazine and the bands that all my friends that were skateboarding, that's who we were listening to.
You know?
And I was listening to a bit of that Henry Rollins spoken word, like, I'm a rat type, that whole thing. And then a friend of mine played me Metallica, Kill 'Em All.
Yeah.
And I went, this is aggressive, and some of this sounds punk rock, but there's a difference in the guitar playing. These are riffs.
Yeah.
These are, there are dynamics in the playing. They're not just chords that are being, you know, slammed through. There are pauses and mutes and hesitations and single notes paired with a chord being thrown in and quick picking. That's all these different dynamics in the guitar playing. And I thought, I want to learn that.
Yeah.
I want to learn how to play like that.
Yeah.
And I got on it, and I got then I got Master of Puppets, and I got the tablature book and started learning the tablature to Master of Puppets. And then from them, I went thrash metal crazy and was listening to, you know, Testament and Megadeth. And I think Megadeth Rust in Peace was the album that just blew my mind as far as guitar wise, because they had the videos where, see, Megadeth had the videos where they would, you know, show. I remember there's a video called Go to Hell that was off like the Bill and Ted Bogus Journey soundtrack or something like that. But it's a terrible video. But
escape the soundtrack.
Yeah.
It's just
you can't. I love movies. But at one point they're showing all three of the fretboards of the rhythm, lead, and bass guitar.
Amazing.
Across the screen.
Yeah.
The parts that are all being played at the same time.
Yeah.
And I remember just like rewinding the VHS I had recorded the video on over and over and over, trying to watch what they were all doing and how it all fit together.
To learn that part. That's amazing.
Yeah, to learn those parts, and just thought that was such an insane idea to show that in a video that wasn't an instructional video. But then I got into, the next thing was death metal, and I was listening to, you know, Carcass and Morbid Angel and Deicide and a bunch of the bands like that. Death was like the death. I don't really like anything except spiritual healing. I kind of like a little bit, which was the album right before Human, which is still one of my favorite death metal albums of all time. And then they got a little too progressive after that, and I didn't like it as much. But I missed a lot of rock.
And it's greedy to take clearly the best name.
Yeah,
you know, you've got a huge responsibility there.
So yeah, that, exactly.
You've got the name.
You got the name, Death. And somebody already had it. Those other guys had the name Death that didn't work out for them. But I think they got a sweet documentary out of it.
Oh, nice. Didn't even know that.
But anyway, I missed a lot of rock and roll.
Yeah.
Like I missed the Stooges, and I missed Nick Cave, and I missed, you know, a lot of, you know, I missed the Rolling Stones, and I missed a lot of stuff that I shouldn't have missed. Missed James Brown, missed Sly and the Family Stone, all this stuff that I should have been part of me, part of my growing up. I've had to come back to later in life.
I think the good thing there, though, and what people who've not listened to kind of metal and thrash metal and that don't realize is, regardless of what you'd missed there, there's so much technical playing in thrash and in metal that if that's the stuff you're learning, then that's going to be kind of, you're going to be able to backwards engineer that in some way. So when you come back to these other things, you'll have the technical side to be able to go, right, I can learn drumming in this style and adapt this, because although it sounds at points just so over the top, it's like that's a lot of skill and dexterity that is then translatable to stuff of different rhythms and different grooves, kind of thing.
But you miss songwriting.
Of course.
You miss soul and you miss songwriting,
which
I've had to go back and go, oh, because, you know, with my ventures outside of Limp Bizkit, I've thought, oh, I'm writing songs, but I have a gene missing that isn't able to write in the way that I would like to write, because I wasn't exposed to these things
in
my earlier years, and I have to take myself back to school, you know, in a way, and let that stuff sink in.
That's really interesting, and it harks back and calls back to what you were saying about putting restrictions on yourself as a player and performer, because again, it's that. it's almost trying to put that into your musical a youth development. If you restrict yourself and going, right, imagine I'm not as good as I am now. Now that's the point. I need to take these songwriting influences in and things like that, rather than at the point where there's already too much to lose focus on, essentially.
Yeah. And it's limitations are important.
Yeah.
And also exposure is important.
Yeah.
You know, limiting what you have to work with and exposing yourself to as many different kinds of ideas and musical genres as possible.
Yeah.
I think, because that's what makes players great. I had an experience that I was just talking about the other day where I had grown up playing so much with John Otto, who's the drummer for Limp Bizkit.
Right, yeah.
That our playing had developed together to where we had a vocabulary where we rhythmically we accented in the same areas, you know. In 2006, I went to, through a series of events, ended up playing bass in a band called From First to Last.
Yep, yep.
And the first time I just kind of got in a room with them and jammed with their drummer, he had a completely different background, their drummer. He was not laid back. He was pushy and aggressive and he accented parts of rhythmic measures that I was not used to hearing. And I had a hard time at first because the bass player, especially because that was my first venture into, you know, bass is a tougher instrument than, you know, it's given credit for, I think, because any guitar player thinks that they can just move over and play bass. But the problem with that is, and, you know, as much as I tried, I still play bass like a guitar player, but you have to lose a lot, you know, and have a lot of empty space. You know, you have to be very mindful.
I started playing bass years ago when I joined a band where there was two other guitarists and they were better than me. So by default, I became the bassist, which is that misinterpretation of what that instrument is. It's not just, oh, well, the guitarist can do it, or you can just drift across, because it's a completely different,
You're chained to the kick drum.
Yeah.
And you chain yourself to the kick drum, and you can run out a little bit like a dog on a leash, but you've got to come right back to the kick drum, you know, and have, leave a lot of space for everything else to happen, and you can't be greedy. And I think that, but learning to play bass and learning to accent what this guy's natural tendencies were, completely added to my inventory and my arsenal of what I had to work with as a player, you know. And I think that working with other people, you know, and stepping outside of your own comfort zone, you know, and working with new ideas and learning different musical vocabularies is so important to do as a musician and as an artist.
And something I'd imagine you have to force yourself to do when you've got to a point where you're in a very comfortable and very successful situation. Yeah. It's like that takes all the more effort in a way to go, right, actually, let's step away from that for a second to build and develop where I'm going.
Yeah, and there's also a problem with playing too well. You know, like I've... Like learning a lot of the songs for Queen Kwong, Corey has gone, you're playing that too well.
Yeah.
You know, you're playing
it's
that part too
clean, too
well.
It's too on point.
Yeah. You're playing it, like, and you have to, and there's this whole thing of going, it's important to play bad. There's a quality in playing badly.
Yeah.
You know, and playing. There's,
that's what I traded off in my days as a bass player. I'd try and just push people. I'm bad on purpose. That's not. It's like, you know, trying to sell that.
Exactly. Exactly. I don't know. I think that it's just working with other people is important, because you can get too, you can become too confident when you get good at something that you're good at.
Yeah.
And if you don't, you know, if you just slightly adjust the perspective and you're working with someone who is, you know, an equally good musician in a different way, and you get criticized by that person, it's a lot to, it's a big test, you know, for yourself to go, oh, I'm being criticized and no one's criticized me in a long time. And I'm being criticized for something that I've thought that I was, you know, I was,
that
the,
was,
I
was one the of my balls skills, one of my strongest at doing points. This.
Yeah. And, so it's been, I love working with other people for that reason. Kick you down.
Keep you
in line. Keep you grounded.
I love it. So I kind of want to, obviously, as you touched upon there, there's been a lot of different paths gone down on your route. So I want to try and kind of work through a few, and it seems natural to start with Limp Bizkit. How was it when that just blew up in the way that it did? And, you know, how was that from a personal point of view, from a professional point of view? It couldn't have been expected, I guess, or was there that confidence that this is going to be fucking huge?
No, it was completely unexpected, because people, we were, at that time, we were in our hometown of, we formed in Jacksonville, Florida. I grew up mostly in Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah.
And that's where I started playing music. But in Jacksonville, I had been in several bands, and Limp Bizkit was kind of the leftovers of many of the bands that were my peers. You know, people had gone off to work other jobs and gone to college, and we were sort of assembled, the people that still wanted to play music assembled and kind of. And Fred at that point was, I was 20 years old, and Fred was 25, and he was already really keen as far as, like, you could tell the guy was a businessman.
He
was driven.
Yeah.
And he was picking who was going to be in the band.
Yeah.
And he's a very charismatic guy, and he gets, I don't know, he gets maybe more shit than Vanilla Ice gets as far as, like, disrespect in the world. But the guy is, he's very self-aware, and he's very good at convincing people of a lot, you know, of himself. He's very confident. And he was just that way. And he talked to people like, when we were nothing, he talked to people like they owed him the world.
Yeah.
And I think between that and then us making flyers and going, we would make flyers for shows. We would play like one or two times a month, and we would go to high schools, all the high schools as they were letting out, and just flyer everyone as they came out.
Yeah.
And we tried to make our shows events, you know. And I think we played between 8 and 10 shows in our hometown and in Jacksonville. And then after that, we were being asked to go to Orlando, to Tampa, to Atlanta to play. And then we were on tour with the Deftones. Then we were on tour with House of Pain, doing regional stuff.
Crazy.
And then there was a band called, do you remember a band called Sugar Ray?
Yeah, I remember Sugar Ray.
Yeah, they were opening for us in our hometown. They were signed opening for us in our hometown at like the biggest venue, biggest club venue there
was. Crazy, yeah.
And then that was when we left for tour, and everything just went nuts. And I constantly was in disbelief of it of things happening.
On what you were saying there, I think so many new bands don't realize how much, and it sounds like Fred was an essential element in that, in how much, how important perception is, and that if you give off that you're successful, then, you know, you'll, if you do it well, you'll get that respect, you'll get those, you know, people won't just think, oh, we're booking another band to come and
commanded
fill some doors.
People.
You're like, right, no, we're booking the band. This is a big deal. And that comes across. And particularly if you've got someone on stage, or everyone on stage is having that same, that same approach and look of, right, this is, as you said, an event. This isn't just a gig at your local. This isn't your Thursday night gig that you come and see any band that's on. you're coming to see us. And this
yeah,
is a,
we worked really hard and practiced all the time and yeah. got really tight and wrote 10 songs, then threw them out and wrote 10 more, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
and he behaved like people owed him something
yeah.
right off the bat, like yeah. promoters, booking agents, club owners. He it wasn't like, can we get a gig at your place? He went in with, why should I let you
yeah.
allow, why should I let you have my band play here?
Yeah, yeah.
Why should we play at your club?
Yeah.
You know, and that was how he treated everyone.
Yeah.
And you know, and then he had us to back it up.
Yeah.
You know, and we played, we delivered on shows, and I couldn't believe it. It was just, it's one of those things that, you know, it doesn't happen very
yeah.
often.
Yeah, that's beautiful. How taxing is that, though, having someone in a group who's that strong-minded in that way? I remember when we were hanging out in LA a little while ago, you just got back from I think from going on a holiday with Fred
mm-hmm.
And going away, and you were saying how beautiful it was that, because obviously it's well documented that there were times in the band where you
yeah.
fell out hugely and all that, and you were saying how beautiful it was that it's like, we're just, it's just friend, it's not a, it doesn't feel like
yeah.
a band anymore,
yeah.
it feels like my friend here again. So how was that, and how did that kind of come back round? Because obviously when you're touring
yeah.
anyway, it's tough, but if you're touring with someone who's got that strong a drive and stronger personality, I guess, you can imagine that there's going
yeah.
to be some tension there at points.
Well, it's the rise and fall, you know, and then kind of sorting things out in the ashes afterwards,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
It's the rise to the top and then the fall of the band, and then, you know, years later going, hey, do you want to try doing this again?
Yeah.
You know, as adults.
Yeah.
You know, do you want to see if we can go book some shows and maybe make a new album? And, you
yeah.
know, we missed playing with each other. We felt, because I was furiously angry
yeah.
for years because of all the headbutting, and
yeah.
I had so much animosity, and he did towards me too.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I woke up one day and I just wasn't angry anymore. And I don't know what happened. I don't know if it was time or maturity or,
yeah.
you know,
it's what crazy happened, how simple a thing it can be. That it can just be a, yeah, I'm not,
yeah,
that doesn't mean anything to me anymore. It meant the world to me
then,
a week ago,
yeah.
and now, it, yeah, kind
yeah,
of cool with that.
Yeah, it's weird. But, and it's not to say that we don't have, you know, our issues, and it's not to say that we don't argue about things
yeah,
now.
Of course.
Because we do. But we talk about them in a diplomatic way, which is completely different from how things used to be.
It's such a stupid and easy explanation of just, people forget that people in bands are just humans.
Yeah.
And the fact is, everyone, when you have a period of your life when you're younger where everything is a bigger deal, and then you do just get older and you grow up and you learn how to
yeah.
resolve problems
and how to disagree. We're not important. Nobody
no.
fucking cares.
Exactly.
Like,
and
we're, you know, we're in a stupid rock band that some people like.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not a big deal.
It's beautiful how when you realize that you don't all have to agree on everything. And again, I think that's a grown-up
yeah.
thing to go, right. So, for example, say Fred has this opinion on this subject,
yeah.
I have this opinion,
yeah.
and that's actually okay. And when you are younger, that's not okay at all.
Right.
That's like, no, fuck you, you're wrong. It's like, it's fine, we can have different opinions, we can
yeah.
discuss these, that's not the be-all and end-all in
Yeah,
in
and
life.
I just go, you know, man, whatever. If it, like, I mean, I get fulfilled in different ways from Limp Bizkit than I do from other projects,
yeah.
and I get, you know, fulfilled from other projects in different ways than I do from Limp
yeah.
Bizkit. Bizkit is what it is, you know. It's
yeah.
it's loved by its fans, it's hated by the world, and, you know, I'm happy to be a part of it because it puts me in a really weird position to
yeah.
Thrive in an environment that isn't conducive to what I naturally do.
Yeah.
And so I've got to find ways in which I can express myself artistically to sometimes an audience that's not going to get or accept what I'm doing.
Yeah, sure.
And make that fit in with what they're doing. And I think that the juxtaposition of that, I don't know why it works, but it does.
It just does. I mean, that was always one of the things I felt when I was at university, and it's when break stuff and everything was huge, and I was massively a fan. I got dragged from one end of a club to another by a security guard just holding me up by my throat because he felt I was going too crazy to break stuff in this metal club. So, you know, illustration of my youth there. But one of the things I think was amazing, and it is, as you said, it's the juxtaposition. And you posted a picture on Instagram recently. Someone had put together loads of your face paints
and
body paints and masks.
By.
And how was that to see? Because that was just looking through that was just amazing. The difference, the amount of, the different styles and approaches. How important has I mean, I know a lot of people will already know, but I know you paint a lot as well. How important was that as part of your expression and part of getting everything across to put that much time and effort and thought into your body paint, your face paint, the masks and uniforms and everything you've kind of have made along the way?
Well, I went to an art school for sculpture and painting, and was planning on doing that for a living in some aspect. You know, my next move was, I was in the band, and I wasn't sure if, you know, things were, as I said before, things were going really well and moving along quickly. But, you know, there's who can put faith in that, you know, because that can just go poof and be gone in one second. Yeah. So I was getting ready to go to look for an art school and getting a portfolio together to submit to different art schools and pursue a degree in fine arts.
Yeah.
And when the ban happened, that stopped, and I didn't want to stop being a visual artist. So I had to think of a way in which I could incorporate this need to sculpt and paint and continue to express myself visually. I needed to figure out a way beyond just making the art for a t-shirt or an album cover.
Yeah.
How I could constantly do that, because I'm compelled to do it. The stage, when the whole, I hate the term new metal because it incorporates, because I hate the music, you know. We started our band, and I started playing the way I play because I loved, you know, Helmet and Primus and Sepultura and Carcass, and combined all these, you know, things I liked into these riffs, and then pretty much fucking hated every other band in the genre.
A label was put on it.
And a label, and, you know.
I always remember when I was working with Danny Lonner on Introduction, and he sent me a few different beats through, and we didn't know each other that well, and I didn't realise he'd be insulted in a way that on one or two I said, it's too new metal. I'm not looking to do a new metal thing, despite but in actuality, number one, there was a fair few bands I'd listened to and loved who were under the new metal bracket. And the fact was, my plan was I want to be rapping over hard guitars, hard drums, heavy sounds, which a lot of that is what you would describe as new metal. So it's kind of, it is a weird thing of that.
But new metal also turned into
that name that came for it.
Like a not rap thing. It turned into like these, like, just corny vocals over bad riffs my apologies to everyone in the world for being responsible for inspiring some of those bands. But the thing was, is we were on the tail of the grunge movement. Grunge was going out when we were coming in.
Yeah, of course.
As far as some whatever was going on in harder rock music. And my need to still do something visual and be in a band that was kind of, I mean, the uncaring of the grunge world, them not caring about what they looked like on stage,
yeah.
really, and being sloppy in flannels and boots and T-shirts and whatever. It was a great time for me to go, I'm going to do this.
Yeah,
and
I'm going to do
something
and
completely different.
That.
Yeah. And, you know, basically wear like kabuki makeup on stage
yeah.
And, you know, do something that was impactful. It seemed like the stage was a wasted opportunity.
Yeah.
To, like, it would be a wasted opportunity to not do something for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And,
yeah, completely.
I felt a little weird that I was the only one doing it at first, but then it seemed okay.
This is what's good about it.
Yeah,
yeah,
it seemed
that's what makes
what's
it work.
Good about it. And, you know, everyone was encouraging of it and just like,
and,
go, just do your thing.
And sticking with it and persisting as well means even more. I always remember when, I mean, obviously I ended up loving all of Metallica's body of work, but I remember the excitement when Metallica came out was that they weren't kind of over the top and like, whoever else was out there doing videos on mountaintops with guitar solos and
sure.
stuff, and Metallica were in an
no
empty
videos.
Swimming pool if they were doing
yeah.
a video or no videos and all that. And then you go forward a few years and they're on the exact same mountaintops doing guitar solos
yeah.
and things
yeah.
like that. So
for the Mission Impossible
yeah,
song.
Yeah, I
yeah.
remember being yeah. kind of annoyed at that. But yeah, that's the beauty of you've kind of acted out against this. And then even though, I mean, I saw recently when you were, it was either on Instagram or Twitter, you were catching some heat for a comment about frat boys or about whatever a lot of the Limp Bizkit fan base
yeah.
became. But that's what kind of excites me about continuing with an endeavor and
yeah.
idea like that is it's easy. It would have been easy to be completely body painted and this alien looking thing in some art house band in Greenwich in, you know, just
oh,
doing
it probably
would
have been
and
overlooked.
It would have
not,
been overlooked
yeah,
and accepted.
Yeah.
So it means even more to be doing that and persisting with that in an area where you're more likely to get people going, what the fuck's this? What are you doing? Kind of, you know what I mean? So it's kind of
what I've recently thought about it is like it's like being in America and being a Democrat voting in a Republican state.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
It's
yeah.
like
yeah.
that's what I think about it is. It's
yeah.
good for people who don't encounter anything like that, even if they're not able to appreciate or understand it.
Yeah.
It's good for them to get a little bit of a dose of something that they're not
yeah.
used to seeing.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah.
So if we can go on, I mean, obviously there was. It's hard to keep track, but there was periods when obviously you left Limp Bizkit, and is that or when you started doing a Black Light Burns?
Initially, yes, that's when Black Light Burns. Actually, there was another band that I tried to do that was way too self-indulgent,
right.
and I actually like a lot of the music that was from that period of time, but it was. A band that I worked on with my brother that was just in development, and
yeah.
we were looking for a singer for a long time for it, and just Interscope kept they were helping us and funding us,
yeah.
and they really wanted me to return to Bizkit, so
yeah.
it was like a thing that constantly was getting shelved, and
yeah, yeah, of course.
When you and my ego at that point was out of control,
right?
Because I thought like. I just came from this huge band. I could, you know, do anything.
Yeah.
And
I was kind of the odd one out in
yeah.
this huge band, and now I can make that oddness its own
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, I can make that oddness its own thing, but the thing is that the hard lesson I learned is that it's completely unacceptable. Like, you can go make music that's like I could go do another Limp Bizkit and
yeah.
kind of hobble my way along with, you know, playing smaller shows and being accepted by, you know, part of the Limp Bizkit fan base. But it's just not when you do an about face and,
yeah.
you know, your whole fan base goes, what? It's
what's
not.
What's going on?
I got a good dose of medicine
yeah.
that I needed during that period
yeah.
of time. And it was a very good learning experience. It was hard years
yeah.
of trying to.
Of course.
Of getting, you know, knocked off my high horse.
Yeah.
Because that's a weird thing to experience. And
yeah.
it's a good, and it's not, you know, I don't even find it shameful or embarrassing. I find it shameful and embarrassing that I needed to be knocked off
my
horse, you know.
Yeah.
Because now I feel a lot better.
It's good lessons to learn, though, surely. But so it felt for me with Black Light Burns, you got to get more of the or experiment more with the visual side of things, and the two music videos that were kind of an extended film. How was all that? Because I was a big fan of them. I'm a big fan of the music video side of things anyway, but I just thought it beautifully kind of took you completely out of a music video for points, but not in a pretentious way in any way. It was just there was so much that was just like, I don't know what the fuck's going on, but I'm happy that it's going on. I'm continuing on here, almost forgetting that I tuned in to listen to music, if you know what I mean. So,
well, thanks.
How was that?
That was a lot of work. And my friend Agata Alexander, who was the director and co-writer of those videos, a lot of that was her and I just brainstorming and working really hard to come up with a way that we were going to pull off all these ideas that we had. And I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to do anything better than than that period of time with Black Light Burns. I mean, that's kind of, we pulled every favor we could. We, we're shooting the whole thing in this like warehouse where they shoot porn, where we got like, this weirdo porn guy to let us use his space, you know,
and it's insane.
We were moving couches around that had all kinds of stains on them to get them out of the way, and just a lot had to happen for that to, for those to go down, and it was absolutely exhausting. I was struggling with drowning during the first video because. I was in freezing cold water in the Pacific Ocean with a diver, you know, on a respirator, trying to claw into the ground, you know, and breathe at the same time, because I was underwater for, you know, minutes before I come out of the water in a single shot of that video. It was a lot of work.
Yeah.
And to shoot that, we had to break into a closed beach at 4:30 in the morning, like right when the sun was... Just, you know, right before dawn.
It's the kind of thing that takes so much work and so much effort, and it's all worth it, but then you definitely don't want to do that again for at least 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
Because it's just one of them, it's like, that's everything, and then the finished product is that reward, and you are like, fuck, that's so good, that's worked so well. We're like, let's not do it again. let's leave it at that.
Let's leave it at that. Let's not do it again for a while. And we were going to do a third one, but just didn't have the energy or the money to pull it off. We were like... There's no way to top the two videos.
Yeah. I mean, we put this podcast out on an app called Acast as well as iTunes and wherever, and we can have links in there. So we would have had a link to these videos the whole time. But for everyone who isn't listening on that, what is the names of the two? Because it's on YouTube as one, isn't it, as well? Or is it
as one. Yeah.
So what do they need to hunt for?
The first video is Black Light Burns, Chapter 1. The moment you realize you're going to fall.
Yeah.
And the other one is Black Light Burns, Chapter 2, How to Look Naked.
Yeah.
And those two, How to Look Naked was that whole thing was sort of the theme for the whole record, because I remember standing in the line at a grocery next to the magazine rack, and there was a Cosmopolitan or something and it said How to Look Good Naked. And I just thought, I don't know, I was getting, at this point, this is a point in which I was in a period of time where I had not been watching television. I'd removed cable from my house. I refused to watch commercials. Yeah. I refused to read magazines or watch the news. I was trying to shut down to everything. I was trying to put myself on like a brain diet where I was... trying to exclude all this, you know, being sold things and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just thought, God, they're putting How to Look Good Naked on a fucking magazine cover for women.
Yeah.
Like, women look good naked no matter what.
Yeah.
And it's just...
House look good naked.
Yeah.
Remove clothes. End of list.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, for some reason, I mean, I'm an easily infuriated person when it comes to many things, but that just blew my socks off. So I just thought that would be a great title for a song. It's just how to look naked.
Yeah. I love it.
And then the whole album just turned into me rant. I mean, most of that album was just me ranting against the world and people watching television. But I don't know. I'm going to do... my girlfriend and I are currently selling our house in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Because I've fucking had it.
Yeah.
I've been there for 15 years and...
It's intense place. It can be intensely
wonderful
at points, but it's intense regardless of the...
It's a city full of actors, you know, and people who want to give blowjobs, you know, to themselves and to everyone around them.
Yeah.
And they... I can't take it anymore.
That's fair.
And so we are buying a... decrepit mansion in Detroit,
brilliant.
Michigan.
Damn.
And are going to renovate it, build a studio in it, and go live in that part of the world. And when I get there, I'm starting fresh. Like, I'm giving all my paintings away that I've done in the past in LA. I'm leaving them all behind, and I'm not throwing my hard drives away, but I'm putting them in boxes and taping them up. And I'm starting a new Blacklight Burns record in Detroit as soon as I get there and set up. And the house we're trying to get hasn't been occupied for 70 years.
Yeah.
So
that's insane.
We're trying to put an offer in on it right now.
Yeah.
And it's 8,800 square feet.
Damn.
And we're getting it for like... $200,000 or something like that. Like,
that's craziness, isn't it? Yeah.
So we're actually flying from London right back to Detroit before we go have a show. We have a show on the 26th here in February 26th in LA.
Yeah.
And we're gonna see it and see if it's wrecked or not, and see how much it would cost to fix it. But the dream is to build a studio in it and put like bunk beds and have bands and start producing albums and getting into the second half of my life.
Yeah,
kind of.
It's amazing. While we're back on Queen Kwong, I'd said before that we'll play a track at the end.
Yeah.
The fact is, it's occurred to me on podcasts, if you put something at the end, then people will stop if they want to. So I would like to introduce a track now, and then we'll play a chunk of that, and then we'll come back to what the future holds. If that's
sure.
Cool. Take your pick.
Track of the week on BBC One was just 2 weeks ago was her song Get a Witness, which is from the album that does not have a label and does not have a release date right now, but we're putting it out and playing it anyway. So
perfect.
Get a witness.
There we go. I will have put that in there.
Yeah.
So that was Get a Witness. So yeah, you said there's no a label. What is the plan for the
this is the Queen Queen? We're looking for a label. We're playing 4 shows right now in London.
Yeah,
looking for a label. We've got massive amounts of people coming out to see the shows. They're all free. I think they're all about to sell out.
Yeah,
and or close to it. And Dan Carter at the BBC has been really helpful.
Yeah.
To us and been just a huge
Man.
Hero.
He's the last one hanging in there of the rock and metal and punk on the BBC.
He's a great dude. Sweetheart.
He lives just up the road from me out in Essex.
Oh, yeah.
Bizarrely. Yeah, he's a South End guy. So, yeah, good dude. So the plan is obviously to get a label then. And then, is it going to be more touring of that? How do you plan to balance whatever the future is for Limp Bizkit, for Black Light Burns, for Queen Kwong? Is it that constant rotation?
Yeah, I'm
and is it planned out, or is it more, well, whoever finishes an album first, they get your attention for the
It's I mean Limp Bizkit is my bread and butter. I make a living, it's my job.
Of course,
you know, I make my living off of Limp Bizkit, and it allows me to do Black Light Burns and Queen Kwong and do other things and, you know, buy plane tickets and things like that. So I have to give priority to Limp Bizkit, obviously, because it's a machine, and a lot of we have a wonderful crew who's, you know, depend on us for their jobs, and it's an entity, and it is you know, we luckily don't work all year round. Go in spurts. So
yeah, that's great.
The idea is to, in the in-between time, to try to do all the Black Light and Queen Kwong stuff in between.
Is there any plan or even any desire to do just a Wes Borland solo album project? I know you were working on something with Danny Lona and Josh Freese and all that at some point, which, again, they're both guys I have huge respect and love for. So is that something that motivates you, though? Because I guess that has to be the first thing. There has to be that desire to be, you know.
I think it would be
new solo stuff.
You know, instead, I mean, I sort of consider Black Light Burns my solo stuff.
Because a lot of the solo stuff turned into the early, planning to be the solo stuff turned into the,
because I tried to make an stuff, sort of like an instrumental album that was just, it was inspired by Aphex Twin Selected Ambient Works Volume 2, of music to die to,
kind of.
You know, just like soft, non-invasive background, you know, droney noise music. But I kept fucking it up and putting in a bunch of stuff that was more exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but
such a skill to be able to leave gaps. Or Dan Lissac, he helped me a lot with that, where whenever there was a gap, I wanted to put words in there. It's like, right, I need to rap in that. And then there was points where it's like, no, that doesn't, sometimes it doesn't have to be. Sometimes it can just be that.
Stunner.
You don't have to fill it
There's
out.
There's a lot of where
space,
you, where you left let stuff rest and stunner.
Yeah, exactly.
If I did something, I mean, I'm doing a bunch of stuff right now. I'm developing a video game right now that I've written a whole story for, and I'm having meetings about that, that I'm going to be doing the music for also. And I'm not sure what platform that's going to be on, but that's something that I've been working very hard on. But the video game, I've written the whole story out and storyboarded most of the game, but now I've been told that I have to make the game Bible, which is to go in and take every character and write their backstory, even if it's not going to be featured in the game. So
that's amazingly intense, right?
And we're looking for investors, and it's a whole new world.
It's
got
to be a lot of fun, though, to go into those areas that are new to you and learn that, right, here's what I might have perceived is needed to make a computer game, for example. Here's what's actually needed. Yeah. Here's the skills set I need to learn or need to develop, or the depth I need to go into.
There's a lot more depth than you think, because like a lot of the movies you see and a lot of the video games you see and the you know, things of that nature, the ones that are really impactful and really rich, a lot of those characters have these, they write these huge stories.
Stories that aren't
ever presented in the movie,
yeah.
just so they know how the character will behave and react to certain yeah. things in the movie. So that's my next step is doing that. So and then I'm taking 3D animation classes so that I can start animating too.
That's awesome. So would you ideally want to animate it all yourself and be based on your design as well as your story?
I'm going to animate the main character. I mean, yeah. Kung Fu Panda, that movie was made, and I'm not trying to make a movie, but yeah. I'm not opposed to it. But Kung Fu Panda was made just based on that panda with a black background.
Yeah.
It was green-lighted just with that panda moving around a black space
yeah,
on a screen
awesome. Yeah.
and just sort of like falling down and sleeping and throwing kicks and
yeah.
stuff like that. So the idea is to take what I've got now, I've made 3D characters, like the actual action figures of characters in
Amazing.
The game. And it's a ridiculous game and it's really funny and G-rated. It's not,
yeah.
you know, it's for all ages. And the idea is to do the Bible, write the Bible for it, and then animate the main character.
Yeah.
Learn enough about 3D animation to animate the main character. Because I tried to get a freelance guy to do it, and they quoted me $70,000
wow.
to do a 2-minute animation.
Wow.
And I said, no thanks.
I don't have
$70,000 to give you to do that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to just, you know, learn That's to do insane. It myself. But the solo, back to the solo
yeah,
album
yeah,
music,
yeah.
is another idea I have about moving to Detroit into a big, scary, haunted-looking house was to shoot a horror movie in it
wow.
and do the music to that.
Yeah.
Because I've been... I was staying in one of the reasons I was staying in LA for so long is because I was trying to get into film
yeah.
scoring and doing music for films. And I ended up, it's funny because when you think about, when musicians think about like, I'd love to score a film, I'd love to score a movie, you know, you're thinking, I want to be Danny Elfman.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
what
yeah,
people
yeah.
are thinking.
Yeah.
And then you start taking meetings and you realize that most of the guys in those, who are doing that are like doing movies like Horrible Bosses 2. And
yeah.
and you go, that fucking sucks.
Yeah.
I worked on a Miley Cyrus movie. I worked on the movie Baby Makers, which was from the guys that did like Super Troopers, like
yeah,
that
yeah,
whole
yeah,
group
yeah,
of guys.
Yeah. yeah.
And I was just having to deal with directors and the composers I was working with, and it's just a shady, sucky, disappointing world
yeah.
and I had a taste of it and
yeah.
and I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I'll do it. I'll work with friends or Agata who did the, you know,
yeah.
music videos
yeah,
or somebody else or figure out how to do it myself one day and score my own movie. That the fourth Black Light Burns album is actually a score to Alejandro Jodorowsky's Holy Mountain. It's an alternate
oh, wow.
soundtrack.
Awesome.
So if you play them at the same time,
yeah.
it, because I wanted to score a film and that's one of my favorite movies. So
yeah. awesome.
That was me sort of flexing my scoring muscles.
I remember when I was at uni, a guy got me a copy of that on video and it was impossible to get over here. It's like you'd read about
you can get
it, but
now.
It wasn't like the internet
yeah.
and it wasn't like now when you can just get anything.
Yeah.
But it was like,
it's on iTunes.
I've managed
now.
To get this video.
Yeah.
yeah. It's crazy. But yes,
I had
a great
the Japanese
film.
Version from eBay.
Yeah,
that I got on eBay that had all the Japanese subtitles. At the
yeah,
bottom of the
yeah,
Holy Mountain.
That may be what I had as
yeah.
well. It might have been. Yeah,
and my friend Adam Jones from Tool is the first person that showed me that movie, and he had it on Laserdisc.
Amazing,
like a, you know, the huge Laserdisc player.
Yeah,
but yeah, that movie's. Amazing.
That's great. That's it's hugely exciting to think of the possibilities then. When stepping away from somewhere like LA where so much of it is set up that you're there to work within that system, whereas if you're stepping away to somewhere where you're working in your own system and whether that be to your benefit or detriment, it's
yeah.
going to be this amazing, yeah, it's this, right, you need to do it all yourself and
yeah.
figure this out. You can't just go, right, well, we've got people all around us who can do this part of it or this part of it. It's
yeah.
like, right, no, you've not. You've not got no, those I people around do it all you.
My,
you
I, need, I need to be in my own...
Yeah.
I need to be in a huge, scary house with a lot of room to work in and do a lot of art and save my money instead of burning through it in L.A., you know, with the overhead that I have there. It's so expensive. And the other thing is Detroit is a really exciting place to be right now because after the bankruptcy, there are artists pouring in wanting to gentrify the city.
Really, yeah.
There are pop-up restaurants coming up all over the place. Chefs are coming in. Restaurateurs are coming in. Gallery owners are coming in and opening new spaces. People are really excited about Detroit.
It's logical because somewhere like that that hits so low and gets so abandoned and empty, there's a point where it's got to flip. The negative side or whatever is making people see it as so valueless, it's got to then hit that level of value, if you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like right now it's... It is what it is. You can do something with
it's
this.
It's
a blank canvas, essentially.
It's a blank canvas in some ways, and it's ready to be steered. You know, there are people who really are excited about coming in and making something out of the city because it's in the shape that Brooklyn was in 15 years ago.
It's amazing. Well, we've gone well over the hour marks.
Oh,
so we'll start to wrap up. Just I wanted to end on social media in general, because it occurred to me as I was kind of going through a few bits, one of the bits in fact, the reason this has happened essentially is I was saying on your Instagram, oh, let's meet up when you're over.
And
it didn't even cross my mind to do a podcast for some reason.
Yeah.
Someone else said you should do the podcast. So it's, how do you feel about social media? I know that I remember when we all posted a picture of you, me, Danny and Travis in the studio.
Yeah.
Tons of people were talking. Still, we've not told anyone what that is. And the reality is, after this, I was going to ask if you've got any space or time to make anything, but you've just listed a million things you're doing at the moment. So
yeah, but the internet is great. The internet is great. And, you know, sending tracks is great. And
exactly. It's amazing. But yeah, what do you think of that? Because I also feel, obviously, when... I was thinking back and I was thinking when you left Limp Bizkit, a lot of it seemed to be publicly over MySpace. And I was thinking when a few years back when Lethal wasn't part of the... I remember kind of tracking that on Twitter. How key has it all been and how do you feel about that? Is it a love thing? Is it a love-hate thing? Is it just a happy medium of social media making everything so public? But... Yeah, I don't know. A taking down so many of the boundaries, in a good or bad way.
Well, recently I've just started to have more fun with it over the past couple of years because it can be so vicious and so stupid and so rewarding and so empty all at the same time. And it's a way to kind of share. Share things about yourself that people wouldn't normally know.
Yeah.
And
I think it can be absolutely key for getting across a truer perspective of who you are rather than the perspective that's put across on stage or in this small chunk of you that the public are getting to consume that is packaged and marketed and made a certain way. It's kind of a real way to get more of that across.
I've gotten a little bit of heat, which is fine, but I've started acting on social media in a way that was in opposition to how I saw other people using it, which was people kissing asses, being overly grateful and thankful to their fans for supporting them or people for supporting them, trying to present a false... persona of themselves. Or trying to be really politically correct. I've started just talking on social media like I do to my friends.
Yeah.
And it's been
it's
dangerous, but I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, no, completely.
And cuz there are some people that have just make me sick on social media with how fake they are and how just how they use it as just a shameless promotional tool. Yeah. And, you know, they're, I just think it's hilarious to have fun with it and to not take it so seriously and to actually have a connection with fans.
Always find the less I have to promote, the more fun I'm having on social media.
Absolutely.
When there's an album or anything else, it's like, that's the fact, it has to become a promotional tool as well. There's no denying that in a way. It's something that gives you that access.
But and I always the think, most oh, fun fuck, I have, we have to promote something.
Exactly.
This is going to suck.
The most fun I have is when it's like, I've got nothing I have to tell you, so here's some stupid shit, or here's some shit that's just interesting to me and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, and then you start to get conversational and people... you see how many people just don't read what you're saying, or they miss what you're saying, and then they and it just becomes. But I mean, I just go block crazy. Like I block people for even saying, like for even, I've blocked people for not getting something I said just because I don't even want you on my in my world anymore.
I love that. I love how people really believe that the blocking is in any way a big deal, and it should be the most casual thing. It should be like that. Like cool. You're blocked now. That's not, you know, it's only Twitter. It doesn't mean I don't want to have direct interaction and conversation with you.
Yeah, you're
not
a person I want in my life. And I don't care if you're a fan or not.
Yeah.
You're a fan of something that I'm not, like, you're a fan of part of me that I don't even like.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Bye. Or somebody will just say, I don't know, somebody is, like, I think somebody even asked me like what I thought of like the Super Bowl or something, and I just went,
"Gone,
you're gone." I don't even
so
want
weird.
Like because I don't watch anything like that.
I have that on Facebook as well. And I think one of the weird things with social media is the assumption that everybody should have the right to want to know everything about you or be a really close. There's tons of people that I like, but I don't need to know everything about, and I don't need them to know everything about me. So I've had people on Facebook before that I've unfriended or whatever who I've not got any issue with. We just don't need to be that. We don't need to have that relationship. And people will often find that offensive, which blows my mind. I don't think that's offensive at all. If someone said to me, like I've got people. B. Dolan, who's on my label and is one of my best friends and things like that, he doesn't follow me on Twitter or Instagram because he's like, I used to, just wasn't really into it, just wasn't my thing. It's like, that hasn't changed our friendship anyway.
No,
it's like, that's
no,
fine.
No.
It's like, cool, that's social media. That doesn't, it's on not the real world. We will talk in real life. That's fine.
On the flip side of that, I was at a dinner last night and one of the people at the dinner, one of their best friends, we were talking about what we're talking about now at dinner. One of their best friends, when he decides that he's going to unfriend someone on Facebook, he calls them and tells them that it's happening.
Wow, that's so dramatic.
And why it's
right?
happening.
Here's what you've done.
And then he says, and I don't want you to talk to me anymore.
Wow.
Ever again.
Wow,
and then
that's
he
dramatic.
Hangs up. Like, but he does it every time. Like, the guy's... nuts.
That's brilliant. I'd be waiting for that. I'd be trying to instigate that just to have that experience.
I'm calling you to let you know that I'm deleting
quick
speaker
you from phone,
Facebook.
Everyone. I've done it. I've managed it. I've pulled it off.
Go ahead.
That's craziness. Well, I mean, all that aside, it comes to the end here. Where should people be following and, you know, potentially getting blocked? What's the... Is it at Wes Borland? Is it... Anything more
creative
than that? Yeah,
it's at the West Borland, because some jerk took West Borland.
Unbelievable. So. I hate when that happens.
Yeah, I hate that too.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. It's been good to
chat.
Always
a pleasure, Pip.
I'm forward to catching the shows tonight. Again, they would have already happened now, but I can't wait to see.
Oh, God, we're playing tonight.
You're playing tonight. Yeah, that's why we're doing this at lunchtime, so you've got time to get into it.
I drove yesterday here in London during rush hour for the first time.
Oh, wow.
And I don't drive stick, and I drove... manual transmission in a cargo van in rush hour traffic. My first time driving on the other side of the road.
That's a hell of an experience.
It was a fucking heart attack. I didn't get in a wreck.
I had similar. The first time I ever drove an automatic in America was meant to be going to... I won't go into any details, but it's someone we both know. I was meant to be going to a wedding with someone, and that didn't happen. So I was suddenly in America on my own. I was like, right, I was landing in where was I? In Boston, I think it was. And I had like a 2-hour drive in the night. So I'd landed at night. I was like, right, now I've got to learn to drive an automatic and drive for several hours on my own. It's
an automatic or a manual?
An automatic, but I'm used to a manual. So okay. As silly as it sounds, it is really weird. So okay. I scared the woman at the rental place because the simple thing I had to learn was in an automatic, just you only use 1 foot.
Yeah.
I'm so used to using two. So I'm accelerating and then I'm braking as I get there, which is making the car jump and go crazy. Yeah. So the woman at the rental place genuinely said to me, "You're scaring me. Is everything okay?" Yeah. And I'm like, "It's fine. Yeah. But I believe that is the reason I now love driving in America, because I had that birth of fire. I was thrown straight into it. I might have avoided it all the time, but
yeah, I did better. I drove again last night when there was a little less traffic, and it was a little bit less pressure.
Horrible experience of rush hour.
Yeah, so it was a little bit better. But actually, someone else did get in the car. Did get in the car and said something's wrong with this transmission.
Oh, really?
They said, this is really weird. It's like not...
So it's a tougher than... Yeah.
It was a tough transmission. Yeah. So I went, all right, yeah. I'm not having such a... I'm not such a pitiful person.
I've done it. It's going to be okay.
Anyway, I
now wish you more luck with the driving than the gigs, because the gigs, you know how to do that shit. It's the driving.
Oh, we got
the
somebody to
part.
Drive for the rest of the time.
Thank Christ.
Yeah, because I'm going to be lugging gear.
Yeah, perfect. Well, thank you very much for coming on. And I'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Pip.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
That was Mr. Wes Borland. Thank you very much for tuning in. And what an amazing chap and chat. I loved talking to that guy. He's a fascinating dude, has done so many interesting things, and genuinely always seems to have me excited about what's to come. So that was good fun. If you enjoyed that, maybe check out the Frank Turner one or the Billy Bragg one. There's been some good ones over the weeks. Let's talk about next week's guest. Now, in fact, first I'm going to ask you to subscribe, because it makes a big difference. Please subscribe. I mention this all the time. I used to mention it at the start of the podcast, and I was like, so if you're going to stop the podcast to go and subscribe, but you're at the end now. So if you subscribe and do your little settings bit, if you set that to automatic download, it genuinely helps us. And I know you listen to this and thinking, I'm not going to do it, but... go on. This is for free and that. So it helps us, because if you do the automatic download, it means we have a big hit of downloads at one time. So we jump up in the charts and are therefore more visible, and it helps to do that. But as said, we're doing two podcasts a week this week. And the second one for this week is Mr. Rob the Bank, who, man, it was so nice to sit down and chat with him. I hadn't realised until we sat down and chatted how big a part of each other's lives we've been. And that sounds crazy emotional, but it was a genuinely emotional chat, and one of the most emotional. I think the Rob the Bank one and the Kate Tempest one are probably on a par there for just, it was lovely. So check that out. That's next week. Until then, subscribe, follow me on Twitter at Scroobius Pipio, or on Instagram at Scroobius Pipio, or on facebook.com/Scroobius Pip. So until next week, this has been the Distraction Pieces podcast. Cheers.